Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well VIP webinar and podcast series. I'm your host, Craig Dowden, and I'm thrilled you've taken some time out of your hectic schedule to join us today. Really excited to have you with us and to dive into an incredibly relevant and increasingly timely topic this morning. Now, for those of you who are return listeners to the live webinar, as well as return listeners to the podcast, very warm welcome back. Love your support, love your feedback, love your encouragement, love your participation in this community. It's just been absolutely awesome. For those of you who are new to this community, an equally warm welcome. It's great to have you with us. Love creating this opportunity to have such engaging dialogues with global thought leaders. And before we start the conversation, a very heartfelt expression of gratitude. The Do Good to Lead Well podcast, because of your ongoing support, is now in the top 0.5% of podcasts globally. So that's just absolutely extraordinary. And it's directly as a result of your ongoing support. And another primary reason is because of the amazing guests that we're able to attract to this program. And this morning, Nathan Furr is no exception. He's a professor of strategy and innovation at INSEAD in Paris and a recognized expert in the fields of innovation and technology strategy. And you talk about a time where this is needed today and tomorrow, is it? Professor Furr earned his PhD from Stanford University and studies innovation. So how to get ideas, test ideas with support for ideas and create a culture of innovation, technology, and uncertainty. His best-selling books include The Innovator's Method, Harvard Business School Press, Leading Transformation, Innovation Capital, and The Upside of Uncertainty. So again, an extraordinary track record on topics that are very important for us in our personal and professional lives. He has published broadly in Harvard Business Review, Sloan Management Review, Forbes, Inc., lots of different academic journals. He's an InnoSight Fellow and has been nominated for the Thinkers 50 Innovation Award. And that's kind of just the tip of the iceberg. I couldn't go through everything. So Nathan, a very warm welcome to the program this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me. And hopefully I can live up to that introduction. Holy smokes.
And I'm just, as ongoing listeners know, I'm old school kind of. This is a fantastic book. I have to say, congratulations right out of the gate. For people who have followed this podcast and webinar series for a while, they know I am passionate about evidence-based insight and research-driven practices. And the book is just this beautiful combination of research and practice. And every single chapter for everybody here, at the end, you have reflection question exercises. And these aren't more abstract, kind of higher level. Some are, a lot of them are just, this is a concrete examination of a particular topic. And what I love most, Nathan, is that you really bring some counterintuitive pieces to the table for us to reflect on. And I'm really excited to get into this today. So perhaps you can share the origin story of the book, where I love the personal side that you share in the book as well. Where did this idea come from, and what's that journey been like for you?
Thanks so much, Craig. I mean, part of the reason why the book, The Upside of Uncertainty, is so practical is because I find uncertainty hard. I find it frightening. I find it challenging. So So I'm pretty obsessed with how do we do this? But in addition, I see in my daily work with companies that organizations and leaders struggle with this. So they say they want change, they say they want growth or transformation or whatever, but as soon as it gets a little uncertain, they back away. And so where does this come from? It really came out of this 20-year quest. So I've been interviewing innovators from around the world. And the thing I noticed is that while I admired and I got excited about the new thing they had done, it always came paired with uncertainty. In other words, they had to step into the unknown to do anything new. And so for my own self, I started asking questions like, well, so how did you do that? How did you make the decision? What did you do? And then as that came together, I thought, well, gosh, surely my colleagues in the academic world have come up with an answer to this question of how do we get better at navigating uncertainty? And as I dug deeper, I found really there were bits and pieces. It was clear you could get better at this, but that really there was this really critical missing skill, which is how do we learn to face uncertainty, have courage, and see the possibility that's hidden in that. And that this was a crucial element of great leaders. Great leaders have figured out how to do that, but they also sometimes struggle to communicate that. So how do we do it? So it became much more of a systematic research program as I realized there was this big hole around what I would call uncertainty ability, or the ability to face uncertainty well and turn it into possibility.
What I appreciate as well in terms of the construction of the book, it's just, you almost have a sense of you're having a conversation as you're writing it, which I thought was really cool. It's like you and I, just like this morning, it's you continually reflect back on your own journey, your own experiences. And I appreciate the passion for it. It spoke to me a lot about, hey, how do we figure this stuff out? And so I've already got a question from David saying, I love the title of the book, yet for me, all I tend to see is downside. Like, is that normal? And why am I so uncomfortable with uncertainty?
That's totally normal to see that, by the way. And I will say, and you know, Craig, when you mentioned that it has this personal tone, I have to give credit to my co-author, whose last name is Furr as well, Susanna Harmon Furr. We've been married 27 years, and she's like the innovator and the creator, and she's the one who does it well. But in response, and so she really, by the way, really pushed for that human side of it. So we really try to write it to the human inside the manager or the leader or the CEO or whatever it may be. That question, I only see the downsides. Well, like you are so 100% normal because actually our brains have been wired by evolution to be afraid of uncertainty. And why? Because think, you know, a million years ago, what were the benefits of wandering too far from your tribe or your cave or whatever it was? It was small. You were probably going to starve, die, get eaten, fall, you know, any number of bad things. And so uncertainty was a signal, don't go there. But what's changed is we no longer live in that world where you're going to, you know, you go 10 miles from your house, you might get eaten. But we do live in a world of incredible change and dynamism that is full of opportunity. So we have this evolutionary wiring that does not help us in this world full of change and dynamism. And so the reason why we called it upside of uncertainty is actually the working title before that was uncertainty possibility. And we'd kind of mash those two words together because the fundamental thesis is look at every achievement in your personal life or that an innovator has made or a change maker has made. It was always preceded by uncertainty. And so uncertainty and possibility are really two sides of the same coin. And this is where it gets really important because if we're always seeing the uncertainty side of the coin, we will run away from it and not get to the possibility side. And so you're totally normal. I feel the same exact way. And it's how do we learn to see the possibility side so we can get through the uncertainty reaction?
Well, and thank you. I've already got multiple comments on that answer and great. And people say, yes, that's me. That's me. And I have to say, Nathan, I was drawn to the book because of the title and not just because of your previous books. The title of this book is really engaging. And a thank you and congratulations to Susanna because yes, mission accomplished on that for sure. And it's so fascinating when we sit back and I reflected in my own life about, okay, so when are the moments when there was the highest level of growth, the biggest possibilities that opened up for me? It really was an uncertainty. And I love how you get us to think about, and I'm excited to dive into right away, that mindset shift about how we're actually looking at this. And you talk about the idea of a first aid cross for uncertainty. Can you just, as to set the stage for this, can you talk through those components?
You know, for me growing up, maybe there was something wrong with my school or maybe my parents or something, but I just felt like I wasn't taught how to face uncertainty well. The question I believe we have as individuals, as leaders and organizations in a world of increasing uncertainty is, well, how do we build this uncertainty ability, this thing that change makers and leaders have that helps them be calm in the face of the unknown? And so we came up with all these tools. We actually came up with 42 different tools, like trying to get really practical, like how do I do this? And that's way too many to remember. But we noticed they did kind of agglomerate around four categories of things to do in the face of the unknown. We came up with this metaphor of a first aid cross. It has four arms. The four things to do in the face of the unknown. First and foremost, the category of reframing whatever it is you're facing in terms of the possibility side of the coin, not just the uncertainty side of the coin. Number two, there are things you can do actually to prepare in advance, what we call prime. Number three, taking action is one of the best ways to resolve uncertainty, but the research suggests there are some better ways to take action than others. And then number four, inevitably, when you step into the unknown, something will go different than you expected because that's what uncertainty is. You don't know. You can't guess or plan your way there perfectly. So how do you sustain yourself and your team when there is an inevitable setback and instead be ready to take the next step? So that was the idea, these four categories of things to do to build your uncertainty ability like a muscle and also help you in that moment of maybe anxiety or decision or crisis.
Well, and thank you. And just right away in that opening chapter of laying it out in that way was so powerful, really brought me in because you go, okay, this is what I appreciated about how it was broken down is that, okay, it's starting with, and I want to ask you a question about this, like our mindset towards it. And then as you say, the priming, the doing, and then the sustainability and the skill-based nature of this, because a lot of times, you know, I sense that people think, oh, well, either I'm born with this skill or I don't. Like I'm comfortable with uncertainty or I'm not. In the book, it's pretty clear we can grow that muscle, right?
Absolutely. So I want to be frank that the cutting edge of neuroscience, the kind of current agreement is that everything in our lives is a function of three factors. So we've got to acknowledge that. One is genes. We all come with some natural predisposition. Number two is the experience we have. So how you grew up and your environment will shape how you react. But number three is learning and that we do learn. And so what was very clear from the research here, and I want to acknowledge again, genes shape something, experience. If you grew up in a really uncertain environment, you probably will know many of the things I will talk about, but maybe not be able to put words around it. So maybe what I can do is help you communicate what you learned to others. But the research was very clear in the field, in fields with labels like ambiguity, tolerance, and resilience, and uncertainty avoidance, that people learn this and that they can get better at it. And those who develop it, and this is from some of the research, they're more creative, they're better entrepreneurs, they're actually better managers and strategists, and they're more adaptive and they're less anxious. So all these good benefits. But again, so I read that stuff and I was like, oh, this is amazing. I don't have to go out and do this research. I can just find out how. And then it was like, oh, that's where I was left hanging because the how was really where it was vague. Those of you read an author, like I admire some of the work of Nassim Taleb and this idea of anti-fragile, that you're strong in the face of volatility. But then when you get to the how, it's kind of like, well, there's a couple pieces, but not enough to like systematically build this muscle yourself or train it in the people you lead. So that's what we were trying to get at.
Well, and I love that combination, because I appreciate that in the framing of it, you talk about, well, there are genetic influences, there are environmental influences, which certainly are there. And then there's also one that we have control over, which is, okay, how do we approach these things? How often do we engage in practices that help build our ambiguity muscle? I think that's just such an empowering idea. It's such a powerful idea and a great reminder for each of us around, okay, so what choices am I making to be able to engage more effectively in a world that's getting increasingly uncertain, as you talk about throughout? And I love that you start the book with reframing. And I'm guessing that was an intentional choice on your part, or I'd love to hear what prompted you to start from that perspective.
Yeah, so I want to acknowledge that some of the tools are a little more maybe conceptual or cognitive in nature, meaning it's about how your brain works. And some of them are a little more practical, tactical, like this is what I set up and do. And while I acknowledge that it's sometimes hard to talk about cognitive things first, we started with reframe because it is really the first and most important thing to do in the face of uncertainty. So really quickly, framing is this very well-established effect in psychology and behavioral economics, which says the way you describe something changes how you think, decide, and act. And in the very famous study, you may already know, Kahneman and Tversky give people this situation. There's a disease, there's two treatments for the disease. And if I oversimplify, effectively, one treatment has about a 5% chance of failure, the other has a 95% chance of success. Now, we all know those are statistically identical, but knowing that and being able to calculate that, we all still choose the 95% chance of success treatment because our brains are wired, again, by evolution, to be gain-seeking. We want to win and loss-averse. We don't want to lose. And so this is really important when it comes to uncertainty, because if uncertainty and possibility are two sides of the same coin, then if we're framing in terms of the uncertainty, we'll run away from that coin. Versus if we frame in terms of the possibility, we trigger that gain-seeking part of our brain and we move towards it. And this is so important. I'm sure we've all sat in a meeting where something gets framed in terms of the loss, in terms of the uncertainty, in terms of the risk. And suddenly people were in support, like back up and say, like, oh, that doesn't sound good. Versus when you see a really masterful presenter frame in terms of the opportunity, and suddenly people are like wanting to get on board. And this is really important because, again, we talk about two kinds of uncertainty in this book. There's the uncertainty you choose when you say do something new, but there's also, I want to be clear, uncertainty happens to you whether you choose it or not. We're all living through that, right? We all lived through that when we went through COVID, and it happened to you. And here's where it gets really critical. How you reframe those uncertain events also shapes how people think and decide and act. And so I saw leaders in COVID with good intentions. Maybe they thought they were being transparent or whatever, but I saw them frame this rare pandemic event as saying things like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to us, or this is, quote, worse than the Great Depression. Now, what are you doing as a leader right then? You're framing in terms of the uncertainty. And what happens is everybody starts to freak out. They start checking their bank accounts and say, how do I get a new job? And they spend their whole day worrying instead of doing any work. Mm-hmm. And I contrast that. My favorite contrast there is with how Brian Chesky, who was the CEO of Airbnb, framed the same exact event. Now, they lost 80% of their business in 8 weeks. So that's radically challenging. That's just an incredible amount of loss. And he did acknowledge that it was a crisis. You can acknowledge the uncertainty side of the coin, but he didn't leave it there. He said, if you look back in history, the great moments were forged in moments of crisis. This is our moment to show what we're made of, that we're one of those great companies. See, that's framing in terms of the possibility, no matter how slight. And mm-hmm. And that framing is what allows people to have the energy to move forward. And Craig, I'm sorry to keep going on, but I see this so often. I was just for fun reading a book about World War II and about many of the great leaders. Of course, we know about, you know, like Winston Churchill and stuff, but there's others. There's Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands, King Haakon of Norway. There's Charles de Gaulle of France. There's all these others. And what every single one of them had in common is there was a situation that seemed totally hopeless. When Charles de Gaulle goes to England, he's the only military leader who goes. And the people in England think, wow, France is a lost cause. But what he does and what all those other leaders did is they painted the possibility, nonetheless, in that uncertainty. And so I really think this is fundamental to leading yourself and leading others through this, through the unknown.
And again, so many great comments coming through, Nathan. And I love that idea because as I continue to read the book, you challenge the readers in terms of how we are framing things. And I really appreciate that. And through the types of questions, like you'll challenge us, okay, what kinds of questions are you asking yourself around a particular a topic, issue, opportunity, situation? And then also kind of like, and what about the counterbalance question? Like, what about the other side? And I think it's so really important for us to think about those things because depending on, as you say, how we frame it, how we state, this is the worst thing ever. Well, right away, we are creating and driving a particular narrative, which I guess really beautifully connects me with my next question because I love that you dedicate a chapter to stories because I feel like our stories, our personal stories, our professional stories are so important. So can you talk about that idea of stories and how they impact us so profoundly?
So the story is something we talk a lot about in business, but that we rarely use well. Now, what you should know about story from the applied neuroscience is that it's not just a soft and fluffy thing. What the applied neuroscience shows is that when we tell stories, if I tell you a story, our brains will literally start to sync and couple, meaning our brain patterns will mirror each other. It is literally changing how our brain operates as we tell it. Stories are this really critical thing to think about and to carefully shape because they help you make decisions. And if I could give you some examples, maybe this time a little more personal. You mentioned that I'm in Paris. I am. I'm a professor at what is the kind of top international business school. But before that, I was very comfortable living in the United States. I had done my PhD at Stanford. I was at a very good university. But I got this offer, this kind of dream job to live in Europe and with one of the top five business schools in my domain of strategy. And I remember it was such a hard decision. And I kind of had this little narrative in my mind because my kids were in school where we lived. One was in high school. We had in-laws living up the street. I was going to get the job for life versus, you know, at INSEAD, the bar was about double that. And I remember telling myself this story about how could I disrupt my family to take them to do this risky, uncertain thing of moving to another country and another institution. And I was like, how can I justify that morally even or ethically, whatever you want to say. And I remember I called up my grandmother, who it was a very feisty character who fought throughout her life for civil rights and mental health services. And I told her my whole dilemma, long-winded as usual. And she just almost cut me off and said to me, Nathan, parents teach their children to live their dreams when the parents live their dreams. And it really helped me cut through the confusion. And it really introduced a different story about what this was we were going to do. And I carry that story with me in through the hard times that were part of the adaptation to a new culture and a new institution and all those things. And now I'm just so grateful that I did that. And so we actually get to choose these stories. And the last thing I'll say about that, choosing your story, when I went to write this book, you know, I've written a couple books and there was this conversation with my life partner, Susanna. We've been married 27 years because, again, she's the innovator, she's the creator. And I would go out and interview these superstars and come back and tell her about it. And she'd have some great idea. And a week later, suddenly that was my idea, in quote. And we had this heart to heart where she kind of said, well, maybe we should collaborate on this. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking about suddenly in that moment that my life was in many ways like a bookshelf with many different novels on it, each novel with kind of a different version of the story. And I had to make this choice about, well, do I do it by myself? Do I collaborate with another academic colleague? Do I not do it at all? Do I do it with her? And I kind of thought through, well, what story would I want to pull down off that shelf the most? And for me personally, it was to figure out how to collaborate with this brilliant person who I also happen to share a life with, and to explore that possibility. That was the story that was most interesting, even though it was scary for me. It was different. It was new. And later, a friend of mine said, well, Nathan, you are the lucky one that she decided to partner with you. And they were right. But nonetheless, that was a new and uncertain thing for me. And my colleagues could challenge me, like, why are these partners working together and all that? But again, the thing that kept me through that is that story. And I always remember back in university, my literature professor saying, what does a story do? It helps you suspend your disbelief and see another possibility. And so anyway, I would encourage everyone to think, whether you believe it or not, everything in your life is run by a story of what you think is true, that you think, oh, by listening to this podcast, I'll learn something new that will help me in my real life. That's a story that whether you recognize it or not. And so to consciously see and shape the stories that we have is incredibly powerful for having calm and resolve as we do new things.
And that's awesome. And again, I've got so many comments on that. And the idea, the fundamental idea that we craft our own stories. And then what is the story that we tell ourselves, that we tell other people? And then the choices that we make, the things that we say, the behaviors that we exhibit, all influence that narrative. And what I love about that, and the quote from your grandmother was one of my favorites as well in the book, because it's just such a fantastic framing of a particular issue and the impact of that framing. And also it really resonated with me is that my story is not the only story in this situation. There are multiple stories that can be told, and I'm impacting that. We have so many audience questions. I do want to get into it. So Trina was saying, when I'm facing uncertainty, I have a lot of negative self-talk. I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to do it, or I'm going to let people down if I make the jump. Any advice for me on how to deal with these emotions?
Trina, that's such a fabulous question, and it relates to one of the other tools in reframing, which we called aplomb, which is a really strange word. It's a straight line. It's from the old French of a plumb line, and it's really about challenging your self-doubt. One thing you should know is that almost everybody has some self-doubt when they step into the unknown. So the very common idea you've heard of, probably called imposter syndrome. Research suggests that 70 to 80% of people also feel imposter syndrome, meaning I'm faking it. And we all feel that. And one of the things that really encouraged me is I looked into the stories of great innovators. I saw they too had that. You know, one example is John Steinbeck won the Nobel Prize in Literature. And a lot of that is around his novel, Grapes of Wrath, that looked at this kind of tragic period in the Dust Bowl era in the United States. And one of the things that he kept a journal, a very private journal during that period. And again, I want to acknowledge we're coming from all over the world and there are great writers all over the world and I love to read them, but he's kind of known as one of the great American novelists, meaning you from the United States. In this, he reveals this incredible self-doubt, like saying things like, I'm not a writer. I'm faking this. Nobody knows, but there's no way I can do this. And yet when you go read what he wrote, it's so magnificent. And so I would just say that, and I could tell you story after story if we had time, of all these individuals who all had doubt. And so One of the ways to deal with that is to recognize that that's totally normal. 70, 80% of people have it. Number two, I would say to open up to your friends who you trust. Again, when I came to INSEAD, it's one of the top five schools in the world in what I do. And, you know, yeah, I went to Stanford, but in between, I was in a good place, a good university, but not top five. And I remember I felt imposter syndrome, and I opened up to a colleague finally and told him, like, I'm not sure I can make it here. He's like, what are you talking about? We all feel that way. It was just such a relief, you know? I think the third thing I would do is I would just take action nonetheless, but you're always kind of listening to voices, gathering feedback, helping guide you on the way. You know, sometimes I think it really helps to act out of your values rather than your goals. And so I think what probably helped Steinbeck through that is he wanted to tell the story that he knew was out there of these people who had suffered that wasn't getting told. And so he kept going so he could share that story well and the best he could do, rather than I'm going to write a novel that wins the Nobel Prize, you know, and that also helps decrease your anxiety.
Thank you. And again, got comments saying, this is great, really helpful. Appreciate your insight. And it's such a powerful piece to accept, hey, this is part of being human. I have an imposter syndrome. And I love, Nathan, how you share, again, throughout the book, your personal journey. Let people know. And guess what? Chances are pretty well everyone you know and trust will talk to. I feel the exact same way. And again, love the emphasis on gathering feedback, being open to other perspectives and how we learn from that. Just terrific. I've got another question from Chris, who says, Nathan, I'm not sure if you can help me with this. My boss promised me a promotion, a raise about 6 months ago, and we haven't talked about it since. I'm feeling uncertain. How do I deal with this situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to actually answer that first and say, I would really encourage you. One of the ways to deal with uncertainty is to take action and to try to resolve it. And so I would say, it's totally appropriate for you, given that your boss has said this, to very gently reach out and say, hey, you know, you mentioned this thing. I wanted to check in on that and see, you know, if there's anything I should be doing that would help with that. And, or maybe you can help me understand where we stand just because, you know, I'm making some important life choices. And you're not demanding, you're just asking to help me understand where you're at on that. But I want to get into this fourth category of tools we talked about really briefly, which is this sustained category, which is, let's imagine that it doesn't go how you expected and your boss is a real jerk and doesn't say anything or says, never mind, we decided to pull it. That's really an illustration of what I talked about at the beginning, which is things can go differently than you expected. And there's lots of ways to deal with that. One is what we talked about was called the worst case scenario. So this might be what you're doing right now, which is when something's uncertain, we tend to, something about our psychological wiring, we tend to obsess about the worst case in very vague and ambiguous terms and very binary terms, like either the worst case is going to happen or the best case is going to happen, when reality, kind of none of that is probably true. So Michel de Montaigne was this great French philosopher, and he said something along the lines of, all the horrible misfortunes of my life have never actually happened to me. So say, I spent all this time obsessing about how bad it could be, but none of it happened. So what the worst case scenario does is says, unpack that thing that you're afraid of, and what would happen in the worst case scenario? And you might see it's not as bad as you think. And so, for example, again, this was not a pandemic book. I'd started this 20 years before, but the pandemic hit me too. And most of my income comes from things like keynotes and teaching. And that like disappeared within like a week. It was like gone. And I had just bought an apartment finally, and I had kids in university, and I was, you know, so stressed out. I was so freaking out because in my mind, I had this ambiguous, gray, unknown, worst case scenario of bankruptcy and all that stuff. And, you know, I remember this moment when I was so anxious, and my wife said to me, and co-author, if you can't apply these tools, you don't get to write this book. If you can't help yourself, buddy, you don't get to write this book. So there was some pressure. Well, one of those was worst case. So I kind of unpacked it and I said, okay, so let's just unpack the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is actually that the university folds. I lose that job. I have no speaking jobs. I can't pay for the apartment and I can't pay for the kids' school. So what would happen? Well, gosh, we'd lose the apartment. That's true. But I still have some skills and some knowledge. I'd be employable. We'd probably have to move out of the city. We live in Paris. We'd have to move to the countryside. Maybe we'd pick something maybe a little closer to the ocean, a little bit more space, maybe a little bit of, and then I could maybe have a little more time because I'm not working so hard to like ride my bike and do some of the other things. And all of a sudden I was like, wait a second. This worst case scenario is not so bad. That maybe even there's a world where I might even pick it. And so that just helps you to do that. And then also to map out all the possibilities and the probability of something happening. So in your case, probability that your boss blows up and is a total jerk and worst case scenario is probably 2% or something like that, something low. And the probability that they say, oh, I wasn't thinking about that. You, good point. Thanks for reminding me, is probably pretty good. And so actually you're maybe even helping yourself along in that journey. Long answer to your specific question, but I wanted to paint the tool is part of how do we sustain ourselves when there's a setback. And of course, there's other tools to do that as well.
Well, thank you. And I have a note from Chris, a long answer comment and saying, thank you so much for the conversational tips. Like these are really great. I love not demanding prompting on that part and the other very inspiring personal stories you shared. So thank you. And what I love, I'll keep going back to this, which is why I've been so excited to speak with you, Nathan, and share the fantastic ideas in your book and both of your book around this, which is, as you just talked about, worst case scenario, probability consideration, is that what it does, it's not just a blindless optimism. Everything is awesome. You know, like and ignore all those pieces. What it does, though, and it reminds us of, well, we have choices around how we're going to view it. What altitude are we going to take on this? And so then you say, okay, if this happens, what realistically can I anticipate in other paths? And it's so important. I find it just brings this beautiful balance. It doesn't remove emotions from the equation. You talk about that as well. It just really challenges us to take a more sophisticated, more grounded view and recognize, before I get emotionally hijacked, if you will, and start doomsday planning, there are different things to consider. And one idea that I love, I definitely wanted to speak with you about this. It was a mic drop idea for me, is that you had a chapter, Know Your Risks. And then you talk about this concept that not all risks are created equal. Like, I would love for you to talk about that. Because to me, I went, of course, this is fantastic.
Craig, I share your the moment of revelation that you had, because it happened to me. So again, I was doing my PhD back in Silicon Valley, where the entrepreneurs and innovators are the heroes, not professors like me. And I was really feeling down on myself as not being brave enough to take risks. Now, got to give you a little bit of context. I had 4 kids. They were all kind of under the ages of 12. My wife was starting a clothing line that was mostly expenditures at that point, so not earning money yet. And the only income was me, which was basically student loans. So that's like context. But I remember feeling really down that, like, gosh, I don't have the courage to go be an entrepreneur. I just must be kind of a chicken. And so I beat myself up, which isn't helpful to anybody. And one of my mentors there, Dr. Tina Seelig, she could see I was feeling discouraged. And thanks to her, she invited me to lunch. And I kind of opened up to her. And I expressed my dilemma to her. And in the end, I said, Tina, if I had any courage, I would go be an entrepreneur, but I'm just not a risk taker. And she really pushed back. She said, well, wait a minute, Nathan, do you really think there's only one kind of risk? And I said, well, what do you mean, Tina? She said, well, in my mind, there's financial risk. There's social risk, there's intellectual risk, there's emotional risk. We could go on, right? And you, Nathan, right now in this context I just described to you, you don't feel very comfortable with financial risk. And thank goodness you got 4 kids who depend on you. But you do seem like somebody who feels comfortable taking a social risk and an intellectual risk. It was at that moment that it suddenly clicked for me. Oh, The lesson she's trying to teach me is there are many kinds of uncertainty or risk that it really helps to get some self-knowledge first and foremost, because where we see where we have an aversion, and I still have an aversion to financial risk, we know where we, if we take a step, we may overreact. I kind of joke that if I would have gone and become an entrepreneur and risked it all financially, you'd probably read about me in jail because I would have done something horrible to, because I was so stressed out. Versus where do we have an affinity? Like for me, it was social and intellectual risk. Play to those strengths. So fortify where you feel weak and play to where you feel strong. Now, there's a little teeny bit more to the story than that. And that is that sometimes our aversions can hold us back from the thing that's most important to us. And we just don't see it. You know, this is really important. Another mentor of mine at Stanford taught me this, Bob Sutton. We were sitting in class with him and, you know, I was munching on my peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It's a very American thing to do. I was trying to save money, you know, just save $2. And he just pops out and says, well, when I was a student, I borrowed $30,000 to the equivalent of $30,000 in today's money to get my research done. And I was like, what? I was trying to save $2. You just dropped 30 grand. And he said, yeah, because I realized the most important thing to me getting and keeping a good job was my research. So why not put some money towards that? And it's this reflection on, well, wait, just because we have an aversion doesn't mean automatically we say no. That's where we got to get a little more creative. And I love the example, this the entrepreneur who was behind Basecamp and Ruby on Rails, multiple serial entrepreneur. And he says, I hate financial risk. So he knows he has a financial risk aversion. So how in the world did he start his businesses? Well, knowing that, he said, I always had a consulting gig on the side that paid for the startup that I was going to work on. And that helped me be calm and sleep at night. And the same thing now, if I was going to take a financial risk, I'd want to know that I have that and then fortify there. And then lastly, I just say, you know, taking small risks can increase your tolerance. And one of my, now a friend, but then he was an interviewee, he talked about how he took on this new executive role inside of helping lead Sonos, the big, you know, the speakers and all that. And it was really frightening for him. And he said, I was always afraid of physical risk. And so I decided I'm going to take a kickboxing class. And he said, I realized it wasn't so scary. And it helped me build my risk affinity in many areas. And so we can actually build our tolerance by taking small risks. So just to summarize, I said a lot of things verbally. It's number one, recognize the many types of risk and where you have affinities, you want to play to those strengths, and where you have an aversion, hey, take care of yourself and fortify. Number two, that said, don't let an aversion hold you back from the things that are most important for you. And therefore, number three, you can take small risks to build up your affinities, or you can structure it creatively like that entrepreneur did so that you can give yourself calm while you take action.
And awesome. And I love that. And I think as you're saying, just kind of how we're framing that and recognizing, when I look through your book, it's almost like this masterclass in self-awareness on an area of our lives that can create tremendous possibility and opportunity, and yet hold us back. And what I really appreciate, you shine a light on that, and then you say, okay, like, let's bring that out from the dark basement, and then say, okay, worst case scenario, what do I do here? What are ways in which that I can build my confidence? How can I leverage other areas of my risk profile where I'm more comfortable to potentially then address an area where I'm hyper aware, hyper vigilant on these things? And it's so powerful because, once again, it comes back to the choices that we make and what we do. And I just think that is, it's a continual reminder to me that as I move through life and the uncertainty that's going to face me every single day, I have choices about what, how I'm going to approach that and some of the things that can derail me and keep me back or propel me forward. This is awesome. We're approaching 10 minutes left. So this is just great. And I've got another question, not surprisingly. So Barbara said, I really appreciated your comment, Nathan, around values versus goals. I'm really interested in values. Can you share more about this idea with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I touched on it. And actually, to be honest, it's an idea that could fit in many places. But we wrote about it in the do section, or the do arm of the first ACROSS, how to take action in uncertainty. And some of the ideas there, some of the more research-backed ideas are a little more intuitive, like take something uncertain and break it down into small steps or small experiments. That's one of the definitely most well-proven ways to get through the unknown. But that was one of the ones when Craig mentioned there were some counterintuitive ones that kind of popped up that ended up being really important, which is another way to frame it would be to say, is there a way that you can step into the unknown where you don't know the answer, you don't know how it's going to go, and yet not fail? So you didn't have to worry if you're going to fail. You could be assured you would succeed, so you could feel confident and calm. And the answer is actually yes, there is. And that is, as you step into the unknown and do that new thing, to focus on achieving your values rather than some external goal. Now, again, I was raised on the milk of goal setting and all that. And I understand its importance and all that. And I'm not saying goal setting is wrong or bad. It's just that when you step into true uncertainty, it's just a guess. And obsessing about whether you're going to hit that number or not can create a lot of anxiety versus focusing on how do I achieve the value I set out. So let me give you an example. David Hanmeyer Hansen, one of the entrepreneurs I really admired, talked about when he creates a new piece of software, a new company, he focuses on three values: writing great software, treating my people well, and acting ethically with the marketplace. He said, because I have control over that. I actually don't have control over whether I hit 10, 20, 30 million or no million, you know? And he said, but I can go to sleep at night knowing that I could work 2 years on this and it could be a market flop, but I still would have achieved those values. And ironically, now here's the irony, research suggests that when we act according to our values, it actually tends to increase our probabilities of success because people resonate with that. So in his case, they launched this new, very radical new email service, and one of the big tech companies essentially tried to squash them. And because it was his value to act ethically with the marketplace, he fought back. And that led to all this free press and this big market launch that he said, if we had 15 million, we couldn't have had a better market launch than we did because we stuck to our values. I learned this in a very tangible, personal way. Again, we're working on this book. I've been thinking about it for a long time. And COVID hits, and suddenly every thought leader and guru out there in the world who has a bigger trumpet than me is stuck at home feeling what? Uncertainty. So I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get scooped. All this work I've done is going to be gone. And what my co-author really pushed me to do. And my wife said, well, what are your values? How could you act according to your values? What are you really going after? And what happened is I said, well, gosh, what do I want to do? I've done the research I've done. I have my own unique profile in the world. And what I want to do is I want to speak to people like as my friends. How would I help my friends through this uncertainty they feel? And when I focused on that value, it's true. All that stress about so-and-so going to go first or beat me or somebody's going to scoop me kind of fell away because it was about, well, how do I do the very best work I could do? And so I would really encourage you could use that for yourself, but you can also help your teams with that. You know, I mentioned Brian Chesky in the beginning when he talked about for himself leading this company through this existential crisis to their being. He said, as a leader, you can start to freak out. You can ask, why me? You can get paralyzed. And then he said, or you can say, this is my defining moment. It will leave indelible marks. Mm-hmm. And so what he did start to do there is focus on the values that I want to achieve rather than, am I going to be able to pull this company out or not? I'm glad you brought that up. It's one of the more abstract things in taking action, but it actually is incredibly calming. And I would encourage you to think about that in professional and personal life. You know, I have kids aged 18 to 25 now, and we've had some incredible uncertainties with them. And one of the things that's helped me the most is to come back to what's my value and to say, ultimately, my job with these kids is to love them as much as I can. They get to choose their life. They are responsible for what they make with their life, not me. What I'm responsible for is to let them know there's this person in the world who loves them and is there to help them. And you know, that brings down my stress about the uncertainty of what they're going to do, you know? And so I just see this at all levels of life, from personal to professional life. So thank you for asking.
No, well, thank you. And I had so many comments from your answer, Nathan, and people saying, so inspiring, awesome. Someone said, the best decisions I've made in my life have been anchored in my values. Really appreciate you highlighting its importance. And I couldn't agree more. I feel that when we are, and I love that you highlighted the evidence behind that, when we are connected with our values, who we are, how we want to show up and contribute to the world, it's incredibly, incredibly powerful. And perhaps my last question is around, you talk about the idea of emotional hygiene and taking care of ourselves emotionally. Can you share with us what that is about and why that's so important?
Yeah, I think we're in this really interesting moment in the arc of history where we're just beginning to talk about emotions. I'm old enough that when I grew up, I hope I don't offend anybody, but the idea of talking to a therapist was, well, you're something's broken about you. We didn't really acknowledge emotions and how important they are. Now, I want to draw the big arc of history here. There was a time not too far ago that physicians thought that they should not need to wash their hands because as high prestige practitioners of medicine, they're not dirty. They're very clean. So I don't need to wash my hands before I perform this surgery and introduce all these germs into the wound. But now we understand that physical hygiene is a real thing, that we have these physical bodies and there are things, germs, and we need to care for them. And that physical hygiene revolution, which is essentially a 20th century revolution, has increased life expectancy 50%. And I think we're in that moment in history where we're starting to recognize, oh, we have emotional bodies as well. And just like our physical bodies need hygiene, our emotional bodies also need hygiene. And the problem is we're just beginning to figure this out. So one of the most common things I see is you take a risk and maybe this risk doesn't work out. And what do? Do you go away from that experience and say, oh, let me put a Band-Aid on that and take care of that and let it heal? No, what we do is effectively we take the equivalent of getting a knife out and making it deeper. We say, what an idiot I was. Why did I do that? I should have known better. Why didn't I foresee that? Which is like anti-emotional hygiene. And so the idea here is that when you step into uncertainty, it's going to create anxiety. Guess what? Everybody feels anxiety. So how do you apply the tools to do that better? When you step into uncertainty, it'll go different than you expected. So how do you treat yourself well in that moment of distress? We wrote about this really weird idea. I shouldn't say weird, but it was risky for me as a strategy professor. We talked about this idea of a doula. And what is a doula? It is essentially a person who helps a parent, a mother give birth. And they kind of coach that person through, they give them support in this moment. And actually research shows that it's incredibly effective for mothers and babies. And the World Health Organization has said everybody should have that. And we're like, oh my gosh, but think about like what uncertainty is. It is in a way going through this passage into a new possibility that's incredibly stressing. And what would it be like if you were your own best friend in that process, your own doula? What would that person say to you in that moment of you navigating that uncertainty? Would they say, well, gosh, you know, you kind of blew it. You kind of lost your crap with your team there. They'd probably say, you know what? Hey, it's true. You could have done better right there, but you know, you've been under a lot of stress and I understand why. And you know, the next time you could do it better. And you know what you could do now that you screwed that up? You could go back and you could acknowledge it and you could apologize and you could tell the team how you're going to do it better. Or insert team, say teenager, say insert partners, insert whatever. And so it's this just idea, care for yourself, because uncertainty brings up a lot of emotions. And, you know, just use some good hygiene there and treat yourself and others well.
Well, what a perfect place to close the conversation. Thank you. Just so awesome, and continue to get lots of comments as we've seen throughout this conversation. I cannot encourage people to go get this book enough. As I said, this is so great. And I was excited about, personally, I love the topic. I love the layout, just flipping through it and seeing the reflection and practices. And I was really keen on really just integrating so many fabulous evidence-based insights and powerful practices. And where the book, it was an unexpected yet amazing additional benefit, was it's inspirational. Like, it, what I found it inspiring, because what it does is really get you to question some of the beliefs you have, the assumptions you have, the things you say, the behaviors that you put into the world, and start to ask yourself, okay, like, why not? What about? And I love that journey through self-awareness. And it's above and beyond the practicality and the power of these practices. It really is something that inspires you to explore your best self and how you want to show up. So thank you for that. It's been a fantastic read.
Thanks so much, Craig. And, you know, for anybody listening, you can also go to the website, theupsideofuncertainty.com, where you can also get access to some of those ideas right away, especially if you're feeling stressed out. So I hope our goal is to help our friends. So thank you, friends, for listening.
Well, thank you. This has been absolutely fantastic. So Nathan, thank you so, so much. Everybody here, please go check out the website, buy the book, follow Nathan and his extraordinary work. It really does have an impact. And thanks so much for taking the time out of your schedule to join us today.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you, everyone.
Take care, everyone. Bye for now.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden, or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.